Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Food, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Tippin, one of the hosts of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Kate Lebo about her newest book, The Book of Difficult Fruit, Arguments for the Tart, Tender, and Unruly with Recipes, published 2021 by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Kate Lebo is author of the chapbook Seven Prayers to Kathy McMorris Rogers and editor of the anthology Pie and Whiskey, Writers Under the Influence of Butter and Booze, which she edited with Samuel Ligon. Kate is also author of Pie School, Lessons in Fruit, Flour, and Butter, and the Poetry Ephemera Recipe Collection, A Commonplace Book of Pie. Through the Arts Heritage Apprenticeship Program from the Washington Center for Cultural Traditions, she's an apprenticed cheesemaker to Laura Lee Misterly of Quillisasket Farm, which Kate taught me to say, and I think I did okay. Welcome to the podcast, Kate. It's a pleasure to be speaking with you.
Thanks so much for having me, Carrie. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I wanted to start out by saying just how much I really enjoyed the book. At about 10 pages in, I already had a list of people that I knew would get this book. They would get it. My mother-in-law, Pam, who knows the name of every plant in West Texas, her mother, who taught her, my friend Jill, who's a forager and a fiction writer. I really thought of people who would be captured by both the delightful nerdiness of it, but also the loveliness of the prose and the careful craft of the narrative. It really is a lovely book. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. And I love that you talk about somebody getting it, too. I think that
Sometimes
this combination of, trying to make literary work that's also culinary can be confusing to some new audiences.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, and as I've gone around with some of my other books, I always know when people get it.
Well, I'm definitely going to ask you about those genre-bending moments in just a minute. But first, tell us a little about your academic and professional background. How did you get interested in writing about food, especially pie and fruit?
Sure. So my academic background is in poetry. I have an MFA in poetry. I studied writing. I worked for creative writing nonprofits and arts nonprofits before I started writing full time. I got into writing about food in part as a break from the seriousness with which I was taking my poetry studies. I mean, I so desperately wanted to write, an earth-shattering poem that it became impossible to write anything at all. And that was, I think that was 2010, which was a prime year for the food blog, right? So I actually started food writing in part because I had a food blog and I was really grooving on the audience interaction that I could get from publishing any kind of story about pie. That is one of the things that drew me into pie is I was writing about all sorts of stuff, all sorts of foods. But whenever I wrote about pie, there was a special excitement. And I dug that excitement just as a human who likes to have people excited about whatever they're writing about. But then also just that seemed like a sign of, oh, there's something special there. It's not, just the sugar. It's not just the butter, though I'm sure those things are exciting to people. It's something else. It's the expectations people bring to pie. It's stories about pie. It's a family tradition. It's, you know, mythology, all that. So that kind of, that started taking me down that road.
Yeah, yeah. One of my favorite Zoom icebreaker questions is cake or pie. I just say cake or pie. And then we divide the Zoom room in half, cake people and pie people. I'm a pie person.
Right. And it's valuable to have these fights that are not really fights.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, indeed. Well, so where did the idea for Difficult Fruit itself begin?
You know, it began from multiple different places. In one way, it began, you know, way back when I was starting to write Commonplace Book of Pie, and I was really interested in, you know, what would happen within a text if I was combining lots of different types of writing within it. That book has poems, that book has illustrations by Jessica Bonin, that book has ephemera and recipes. And I loved kind of, I love the interaction of all those different ways of writing and ways of knowing. And I also loved how impossible it was to figure out where to put it in a bookstore. I wanted to mimic as much as possible the feeling that I would get when I go into my favorite used bookstores and I come upon kind of a book as an artifact, not the book that I've been told I'm supposed to read, but the book next to that I've never heard of before, you know, that it ended up there because somebody died and, you know, their kid donated their collection to that store, that sort of thing. I was hoping to kind of not only capture the strangeness of encounters with of a book's encounter with a reader like that, but the privacy, the kind of quiet relationship between a writer and a reader when at least that I would have when I would discover books that way. So the book of Difficult Fruit came in part actually from anxiety that I was having at the time about, you know, having written two books about pie, would anyone ever take me seriously as a quote unquote real writer? People were very easily able to swallow the writing about pie. Haha. But I think it was really hard for me to then pivot in an audience's imagination, to have them believe that I could write poems or that I could write serious nonfiction. Or that was my anxiety. Like I said, maybe that was all in my head. Maybe it was both. I was also at the time getting really frustrated with what I kind of viewed as the mere palatability of the food writing that I was reading. I think this is a danger that food writing still suffers, though I think there's incredible complex food writing happening right now. And what I mean by that is food writing that really just kind of sticks, I guess, might be pleasurable, might, you know, titillate the senses, but really just kind of ends with that. What is that? Frances May's book, the Venice, not that the Italy book where she is remodeling her house. I can't think of the name right now. I've erased it from my brain. Because it drove me nuts. And it drove me nuts. I mean, the book was fun. It was a fun read. And then in the end, it's, you know, just about remodeling a house. And I was like, okay, so what? So what? Like, give me something deeper. Food is such a fraught subject. It's such an important point of connection between individuals and communities. But it also, is, you know, can be a really difficult, poisonous, hard thing for individuals and communities. So I wanted to figure out how to write something that would contain both of those elements, because we live with both of those elements all the time. Formally, I thought that would be fun too. Like how to find that essay form that could contain, I guess, the sweetness of the subject, but also the poison of it.
We're going to get along really well, and I'm going to ask you more about that in a little while and tell you a little bit about a project that I'm working on that I think we're going to get together on pretty well. So the book is organized in 26 chapters, which is one for each letter of the alphabet. This is the second alphabet book that I've interviewed someone about this year, so that's exciting for me. And each of those is represented by one fruit. And you've described it as a collection of essays, and I just heard you kind of describe them as essays here too. But the essays do, you know, they have that feeling of being on their own, but they also have kind of a narrative thread that runs throughout and some mysteries that don't get solved until you get further into the book. So take a minute and just describe what this book is. How do you think of it as a unit or as a collection of units? Talk some more about that.
Sure. You know, I wanted to write a book where you could start it at any point within the book, just like you would a cookbook, right? We don't usually go from beginning to end in cookbooks, and I thought it would be fun to mimic that through the structure of these essays. But I also wanted them to build on each other. And one of the important ways that they build is through some narrative threads that I ended up weaving through. I didn't necessarily know that that was how it was going to be as I was, you know, pitching the book and writing the first five chapters. But I guess it became apparent to me as I was getting deeper and deeper into the book that in order for all the different types of knowledge that I was bringing together, all the different stories, all the leaps and associative leaps that I asked the reader to take with me, in order for all those to hang together, I thought it became important to have these narrative threads that they could trace from beginning to end. And I think, you know, you can trace themes from essay to essay, but in terms of the narrative, usually there's just, you know, three or four essays that all share kind of one narrative. So some of that was structural, and some of that was also, how can I keep coming back to this subject now through a different fruit with different qualities that have different metaphorical possibilities? And how will those possibilities allow me to understand, you know, this thorny relationship that's really important to me? They were all thorny relationships that became the narrative threads in the books. So yeah, some of the decision was practical, but a lot of it was, how do I understand this better?
Yeah, I always have to ask, like, what's the hardest letter of the alphabet?
Oh, X was hard.
Of course, yeah.
Right? I hope by then that we're deep enough in the alphabet that the reader will forgive me that I'm not even close to talking about a fruit.
It was one of my favorites, actually. The xylitol chapter, I thought it had some of the best moments. One of my favorite lines of the whole book comes from that chapter about swapping medicines. Oh, maybe so love is just exchanging medicines. We can talk about that some more. Yeah. Wonderful. Okay, so it also, the alphabeticalness also kind of had that reference book for plant identification feeling.
Yes, you
talk about that.
You feel it, right? So, and that came from, again, these books that I was finding at used bookstores that would go from A to Z with, you know, botanical recipes for drinks, or how to cook every vegetable on the planet, and they would always start. They would always go A to Z. And I loved the predictability of that. And then the variability within what I knew was coming next was really fun to play with. It also became really important to me to be able to play with that reference book, the genre elements of a reference book. So the encyclopedia is written as if it contains everything. And it's written, you know, with a narrative voice that is supposedly neutral. It doesn't belong to any particular person, but of course it does. And of course it leaves things out and chooses to focus on particular things and has a perspective. And that, toying with that was important to me because I wanted to call that element of reference books out. But then also for me as a writer, my anxiety was, of course, why did I choose, you know, Aronia instead of Apple? Or why did I choose kiwi fruit instead of, I can't remember my own words at this point, like what I wasn't supposed to choose. Anyway, like, why did I make the decisions that I made? Like, they're arbitrary to a certain extent. And another person would have chosen a completely different fruit. And I also wanted a really good excuse and a really good, you know, good way to paint my own excuse for and a way to show my limitations. Though my research is wide ranging, it is still limited by what was available, what I had the imagination to find, and what I had access to, on any given day. And I guess as a writer, you know, I felt that anxiety of needing to capture absolutely everything about the fruit and being unable to do it. And also knowing I was probably here or there, maybe everywhere, participating in different echo chambers around each fruit that I would always encounter. Every time I did research into a fruit, I would find that, four of my primary or four of the secondary resources I was using would all quote the same primary resource, for example. And it took me forever to realize that was happening. I don't know why, because I wasn't reading them next to each other. But, you know, that happens on the internet, of course, but to find that that was happening in, you know, published books, printed books that I was getting from, you know, Eastern Washington University's library, from WSU's library, astounded me. And it was kind of comforting.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, that it was comforting. Well, that was sort of my next kind of question about that unique blending of the academic through the historical, through the botanical, with the narrative that's personal and often painful. Again, most of the people I talk to on this podcast are very firmly rooted in the academic side of the house. And you have a sources and recommended reading appendix, which I appreciated. And I think readers familiar with this podcast will see you citing sources like Sidney Mintz and feel kind of comfortable about that too. So maybe, again, tell me a little bit more about that aspect of the book. Do you have that encyclopedic knowledge of fruit from some other place, or what did your research really look like?
I guess a stance that I value is that of an amateur. I'm an amateur. I'm a generalist. I'm a poet. I can describe things well, and I can figure out how to relate them to each other, but I'm not an expert in any of the fields that I'm writing about, which meant that I could look far and wide for all the different ways and all the different fields within which these fruits are described. And I can also, I mean, often I would look for an unreliable source because I wanted to see the way the fruit was lied about, or the way the fruit was mythologized, or the way the fruit, or maybe the patterns of folklore around the fruit, or folk, you know, ways of talking about the fruit. Wikipedia actually is a great source to get started with this. There's all sorts that's right, and there's all sorts that's wrong on Wikipedia, right? And so I would sometimes go there just to get a sense of, like, how do people talk about this, knowing that it might not be correct? And then I would go, I am just finishing up a job right now for Washington State University's Health Sciences Library. So the whole time I was writing this book, not the whole time, excuse me, the last couple of years I was writing the book, I had access to WSU's library, which was incredible. So then I would go into their, search it online, and just see what I could pull up, you know, everything from like the price of carrots in 1936 in Pullman to Chinese mythology around carrots. I didn't write about carrots, but I recently did. And those were things that came up, for example. And it just, I guess it got really interesting to me. I felt like my job, besides keep making sure that I interpreted these sources as correctly as I could, was to figure out how to relate them to each other. I wanted, as an amateur, as a generalist, to kind of enter each of these subjects saying, you know, we encounter and live with food in so many different ways, with so many different types of experts are talking to us all the time about our food. We absorb that, we misinterpret that, we enact it in our lives, it becomes, you know, part of the cycle, it becomes a lie, it becomes something we reject, all that. Like, how do I create a web from all this information and turn it into an essay? That was my research process.
Well, so Difficult Fruit, is like some of your other work, where it does cross those genres between creative nonfiction and poetry and recipe. So maybe do a little bit more of that comparison between like Pie School and A Commonplace of Pie and Difficult Fruit. How do you kind of see them relating to each other?
Sure. Well, I see Difficult Fruit as joining, you know, the two halves of my bifurcated creative life. I'm a writer. I'm a home cook. And for much of the last, you know, 20 years, I'm in my late 30s now. I think I had an anxiety that these two things were incompatible in a daily, you know, I have time for this and I have time for that sort of way. But then also in terms of my professional life, like, is there such thing as a writer cook? You know, I suppose. But, you know, if you work for the Food Network, yeah, I think they're related in my sense of play, in my sense of, in my desire to make a seemingly unserious subject serious. My interest in the way that sweetness attracts, but it also can obscure our expectations of it. We might assume that it is shallow, that it is easy. when underneath that there might be something that might be, you know, yeah, there's definitely something a lot more complex. And I mean that as an expectation that I have for books, but also as an expectation I was feeling for just put on myself by other people. A Commonplace Book of Pie arose from playing around when I was in grad school and just wanting to write something fun. And kind of, I'd never expected it to become a book. It was a zine first. So it just, again, it came from this desire to just make something and share it with people. People liked it. I ended up selling 1,000 copies of this little handmade zine. And it became a book. Then Pie School came out of that because I developed a reputation around Seattle for being a good pie baker. And Sasquatch Books was looking for someone to write a pie cookbook. And they asked me if I'd do it. And I said, yes. I'd never considered doing it before. But, you know, you get an email like that from Gary Luke and you're like, okay, yeah, I like your cookbook. And I was hoping actually to write a subversive cookbook was my imagination. I wasn't going to write some sweet little book about pie. And I told Gary that and he just smiled. He was like, okay, so let's see what you make. I ended up, as I was writing the book, the requirements of that genre, I think taught me what was really possible when writing a cookbook for me in that moment. I felt very responsible to the reader to write recipes that worked, to write recipes that could teach them how to do the thing that they had ostensibly opened the book to find out how to do, make a pie. And that did actually put some limits on some of the subversion that I hoped to encode within that book. I tried to get around that through including essays about pie and kind of talking about some of the personal stories that ended up in the book of Difficult Fruit. But I didn't go too deep there because really the subject of that cookbook was pie. It wasn't me. It was pie. And I wanted to honor that contract with the reader. So that left a whole lot of ambition and things I wanted to write about left over afterwards. And as I was on tour for A Commonplace Book of Pie, and then again for Pie School, I would encounter things on the way, like an exhibit at the Mill City Museum in Minneapolis about the Washburn A mill explosion in 1878. I learned that flour is more combustible than gunpowder. And that when it would combine with sweat on the workers' arms, it would make dough. I mean, just the way that flour would start, you know, commingling with somebody's body and could become this horrible, violent thing. I suddenly realized I had a way to explain, you know, the disintegration of a relationship, an important relationship that I'd had with a man who had celiac disease, who kept wondering if I was trying to kill him by making pie, right? Another way that the Book of Difficult Fruit came out of these books was as I was trying to write a Commonplace Book of Pie, a fellow poet, Catherine Ewlinson, I was sharing an office with her. She brought a sack of quince into our office, and I'd never seen them before. I'd never seen a quince before. And I did what I thought was expected of me, and I took this beautiful fruit, and I tried to take a bite of it. And anyone who's done that before knows what a foolish thing that is to do, because raw quince is incredibly hard and incredibly astringent and often incredibly sour. And that was such a shocking moment for me. I'd never been betrayed by a fruit before, right? And I'd never been betrayed kind of by my own expectations of fruit. I realized in that moment how circumscribed my idea of what fruit was. And it was really formed by what's available at the grocery store. And what's available at the grocery store is sweet. It can be shipped easily. It has arrived with all of its difficulty obscured, right? So that seemed like an opportunity to not only kind of expand my understanding of what is in the world and my palate, but to use these fruits possibly as metaphors for other stories within my life. The quince might possibly be the biblical fruit of knowledge, and how cool to have a beautiful fruit that smells amazing and tastes terrible. Be the fruit of knowledge, right?
Well, so the selfish question I wanted to ask you, and I thought it might be hard to answer, but hearing you talk, I think it's going to be easy for you. So I'm currently working on a project about painful subjects that might be raised in a cookbook, and why the cookbook genre, with all of its conventions, makes it really hard to talk about painful subjects. And it sounds like you know that from firsthand. Yeah. So your essays really do that. They touch on all that personal pain, illness, death of loved ones, family secrets, betrayal, heartache, breakups, abortion. And you've written that traditional cookbook. So again, I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about how you, things that you maybe wanted to say in that cookbook, but that had to hold back, and maybe how they come out in this book.
Well, I wanted to talk about death and loss in that cookbook. I mean, that those pie is sweet and puts people in a very good mood. It's also, you know, what you bring to a funeral lunch. It's also, you know, in my life was a substance that while it was kind of giving me a sense of identity and power as a young woman, it was possibly sickening the man I loved, who I lived with, or becoming just a flashpoint between us that made us, that I guess highlighted the ways that it was going to be impossible for us to continue. What was the original part of the question?
Like the things that you wanted to talk about in the cookbook that you felt like you couldn't because of the genre.
I wanted to talk about those things directly. I wanted to tell, you know, those stories in a way that wasn't, you know, merely heartwarming. But again, I think the cookbook is a teaching document. There's a bunch of didactic language in a recipe. It needs to be bossy. It needs to be, it needs to command the reader to do certain things. And it also, it needs really the focus, or my focus on the language of that book really needed to be about this balance between how do I describe this food enough so that people can make it, but not so much that it becomes impossible to get through the recipe while they're practically in their kitchen making the food. That was challenge enough, you know, the not too much, not too littleness of it. And also just trying to put yourself in an amateur's shoes and imagine what is it about the way that I make this food that's just in my muscles, that's just in my hands. I don't know how to describe that part. How do I get outside of myself and find ways to communicate that to the reader? That was a wonderful challenge, actually. And felt, I think, because I think because of the type of, such a good question. I might be repeating myself at this point, but I just keep coming back to, I think because I kept thinking of Pie School, my cookbook, I kept thinking of its primary function as one of teaching the reader, and that those lessons actually needed to be fairly closed. They didn't open up at the end to let the reader, you know, figure out their own interpretation or, you know, see how they feel about it. It was no, like, put it in the oven, take it out at a certain time, cool it for this amount of time. Do not put ice cream on top of it. You know, very, very, I'm trying to say, yeah, kind of strict didactic language was important for making an effective cookbook. And that did not make for, that did not leave a lot of room for the type of essay writing that I wanted to do, or the personal writing that I wanted to do. I wonder how another writer would answer that question, though. How do you answer that? Why was it hard to include this stuff in a traditional cookbook?
It goes to exactly what you said a moment ago about having a contract with the reader. I thought it was so interesting that you said that very word, because that's the very word that I have been using to describe it too, that there's a kind of a genre deep agreement that you as the writer are going to provide something that points towards pleasure, and the reader is going to, you know, receive it and end up with pleasure. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard to inject within that narrative anything that's going to alienate the reader from their own experience of pleasure. Do you, does that sound right from your experience as a writer?
Yes. And it makes me think about the ways as a recipe reader, if I'm not interested, I just put the cookbook down way faster than if I am not interested in a part of a book. I will muddle through knowing that, you know, within a literary book, something might be developing that I just can't see yet. Where in a cookbook, yeah, if I encounter too much friction, I'll put it down and I'll go get another cookbook. And some of that is like, it's Tuesday night, I got to figure out what to cook. There are completely different conditions that I approach that type of book in than I do, you know, a book I sit down and I read because it's a book.
Yes. Yeah. And it's interesting to hear you say that it feels that way as a writer too, that as a writer of a cookbook, you might also be arriving with a different set of expectations for what your reader needs. Yes. Okay, well, let me ask you one more question about the recipes and then we'll take a break. Is the writing of these recipes different from the writing of the recipes in Pie School?
Yes. Oh, gosh, it was so fun to write these recipes in part because, you know, the conceit of the book is that these are difficult fruits. That meant that I didn't have to make these ingredients or these methods as accessible as I felt I needed to do with Pie School. And that's not to say I wanted to obfuscate them, just that it's really fun to go ask the reader to go get something rare or something that they've never heard of and be like, and there are no substitutions. If you cannot find, you know, such and such fruit, just move on to the next recipe. Just imagine what this might be like, sort of thing. That was fun. The other thing that was fun was I didn't feel like I needed to, I was relieved of needing to explain a food form. So Pie School is a one subject cookbook. It was really important. I spent, you know, the first two fifths of the book just explaining how to make pie crust, how to think about pie as a food form. What are the traditions that are, you know, are coming from it? And then we get into the recipes, which are basically all, you know, variations of each other. And I love that about pie is that it's actually a really basic form and that you can understand crust and you can understand filling and it's a container and something that it contains and that's it, you know, where in Book of Difficult Fruit, it was an opportunity to cycle through lots of different food forms and instead show like, how are all the different ways, what are different recipes that will call for fruit? What are the different ways we interact with fruit in the kitchen or at the pharmacy or, you know, when we're making cosmetics, stuff like that. So yeah, these recipes also became a way to show or remind the reader of all the non-food applications there are for fruit. I thought of them as illustrations, you know, and though you can, I think that you could take all the recipes out and the Book of Difficult Fruit would still be whole. If I did that, I would have lost the opportunity that the headnote offered me within this book, which was, I realized as I started writing more and more of these, that the headnote is like the B-side, or it's like this extra little, what's a good word for it? It was, each of them was an opportunity to either include information that didn't fit in the previous essay because of, you know, whatever theme I got obsessed about just didn't, you know, permit this tidbit that I thought was interesting. It was also an opportunity to jump forward or backward in time in a way that the reader would accept and that felt good. It was another opportunity to introduce characters that didn't fit in other parts of the essay. And it was a way to comment on the essay that came before. So in some ways they were like extended footnotes. That was fun. It was just really fun.
It does sound super fun. One of the threads that runs through the book is that slipperiness of food as poison and as medicine, starting right at the beginning with aronia, with bitter almonds and the cyanide and cherry pits, elderberry, perhaps hitting its peak with juniper, maybe wheat. We'll talk about both of those in a minute. But after meditating on this question for the length of the book, what do you think you've learned about this uneasy relationship of food, poison, and medicine?
Well, I think I have to start with what drew me to that slipperiness or that relationship. And I think it really comes from, I mean, I was raised by a mom who had a lot of chronic pain. She suffered from migraines. And one of the main ways that she, or at least one of the main ways I saw her try to heal herself throughout my life was food. Was a bunch of different, you know, ever-changing healthy diets that would work for a while and then would stop working. And so that taught me in a way that I can alter, but I can't ever unlearn the sense that food will heal me. Even though, you know, by my observation, I know that it won't. And I know that it can also that can also become, you know, an orthorexia that in effect becomes unhealthy, not literally poisonous, but like a kind of poison. I'm steeped in that as a primary way that I understand my relationship with food. I also just really wanted to understand the kind of wordless way that I was attracted to food, fruit in particular, but food in general. Why I would view, not view, just why I had this feeling that being in the company of food, making food, giving food, it's wordless. I mean, the obvious things are it's a point of connection. It's a, you know, it's a way of nurturing, it's love, all these things, but it's something else. It's like a kind of craving. I would get super excited about buying 40 pounds of rhubarb so that I could use it all up and buy more. I don't know why, but that's my thing. And so one of the opportunities that this book offered, because I was using foods as metaphors, was to think about the other ways was to think about the metaphors we use to identify what will make us well, what foods will make us well. The magical thinking, if you will, that we have around food. And as I did more research into, you know, the Doctrine of Signatures, into historical uses of fruits. What I found was often this kind of, some of these questions really hard for me to answer because it just seems so obvious that I still have a hard time talking about it. I can write about it, but it's really hard to talk about it. It just feels like that relationship is there and that's something that I can gesture at, you know, through associations and through metaphors within the book. But actually, when I try to sit down and give you, you know, some good vocabulary for why these things, it is true that poison and food are related, I get tripped up. You know, one of the terms that was useful to me was this idea of like a narrow therapeutic index. That was a term given to me by my next door neighbor who's a doctor. And that just means there's a very narrow window within which something that helps you can then start to poison you if you use too much of it. And I love the reminder that these qualities are inseparable, you know, that, or just the reminder that something that, brings us comfort, the very same thing without, you know, changing anything about it, except for the quantity or the way that it's being served, it can become poison.
Well, I was going to ask you about the juniper chapter, which seems to me to be the climax of this thread, especially of medicine and that relationship between juniper and abortion. Mm-hmm. So maybe talk about that chapter and how it might have challenged your thinking about food and medicine. Mm.
You know, I never really thought about juniper as food.
Oh, well, yeah. Okay.
I know it's spice, right? But I never really, even after writing about it, I think because most of the ways that one encounters it is as a flavor, not necessarily as something that is the body of whatever it is you're eating or drinking. And so maybe that made it especially not surprising that it would be used as a medicine, that we were in some ways trying to steep off the active ingredient of juniper to, you know, in the cases of some unfortunate women in history, to cause an abortion. And that's a great example of a food or of a spice that can be used at different moments within someone's condition to produce dramatically different results. So juniper, you know, when given to a pregnant woman, might cause abortion. Or spontaneous abortion of the fetus, given to a woman in labor, might help her deliver that baby. So the opposite ending could happen. I still don't have good language for this. This is such a great question, but I really don't. I think that the book became a space that I can enter where I figured out how to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And still outside the book, I don't know.
Well, I think the Huckleberry chapter too makes another connection between medicine and another thread of the book, which is the sort of inescapable acknowledgement of colonialism.
Yeah.
Anyone who, you know, I read and write about Southern food, and it seems very clear to me that you cannot talk about the history of the United States and food without eventually having to address the fact that Indigenous people and Indigenous knowledge have been kind of erased from that history or obfuscated in that history. Mm-hmm. So in the Huckleberry chapter in particular, you bring up that interesting dichotomy of foraged fruits being free and having that kind of smell of authenticity, but also expensive and easily commodified into something cheap as well. So maybe talk a little bit more about that chapter and the ideas that came up for you when writing about huckleberries.
Right. Huckleberry was such an opportunity to try to contain all the contradictions of a food. So huckleberries are sacred to the native tribes here. They're a really important part of their foodways and their traditions. They're also beloved by the descendants of colonizers, by newer transplants like myself. Everybody loves them. But also because I knew that if I really wanted to dig down deep into any fruit that was, you know, native to this country, I was going to get stories about and need to figure out how to write about indigenous practices in a way that was, you know, okay, I'm a white woman. I'm the descendant of colonizers. And my people were part of the erasure of native languages, of native traditions, and the murder of native people. So how do I write, or how do I acknowledge that, you know, while also writing about the really cool things about this fruit? In some ways, this is kind of like the what you were talking about earlier with cookbooks, where I guess I didn't want to go so far in my writing about kind of my role as a colonizer, I guess, so far into that it became kind of self-lacerating, because I didn't feel, like a useful way to talk about the fruit. It was a way that it would be just become about my guilt. How boring, right? How boring. So Huckleberry was this great opportunity to go talk to Leray Wiley, for example. She's, you know, one of the founders of the Salish School of Spokane. That's the only native language school that's in an urban area in the United States, as far as I know of. So really, really special, cool immersion Salish language school for grades K through 12. And she taught me the words for huckleberry. She told me about traditions and the way that they work with the kids around foods. And getting to bring that story and kind of weave it into, you know, my own, into the story of, missionaries. The story of like missionaries coming through the Pacific Northwest and complaining about, you know, natives, their native converts losing their good habits while they're off in the huckleberry fields. It was cool. And it was a cool, perhaps what was most important about this opportunity for me was like how to, you know, write an essay within a form that could contain all of these contradictions and say all of these things are true about this fruit. I can't solve, you know, the violence, and I can't, I can't necessarily even come to a particular conclusion about how we should feel about this fruit, or how we should, or how I should feel about, you know, my, what's the word? Culpability. Mm-hmm. But that I, as a writer, could just present what is true about this fruit and let the reader come to their own conclusions and let the reader really experience a fruit in all the different ways that it is. Mm-hmm. That was my hope for that chapter.
There's, again, that threat of potential poison. There's the return of cyanide in the pits of most of our fruits, these bitter almonds. The wheat chapter is the one that I think describes that poison the most. And you've brought it up a couple of times too. Mm-hmm. Describing the end of a relationship, the way that food can be healing for one person and poison to the other. Lots of meditation on poison and what does it mean to poison a person. Talk about that essay and what maybe it brings to this question of food as poison.
Well, I think one of the things I was struggling with in that essay was trying to understand how, if I thought I was doing such a good job taking care of my man and taking care of my relationship, you know, why did I feel like I was being buried alive? Why did it end? How does nurturing actually become a substitute for conflict, for necessary conflict? How does nurturing become a substitute for, you know, making hard decisions about my life? And, you know, the way in that chapter, I primarily talk about nurturing is through, you know, making pie. And cooking and the irony of being someone who is, you know, getting obsessed with pies, using pie and other wheat-based foods to kind of, you know, make the rent in between years of grad school, which is what I was doing at the time, while living with a man who I loved who had celiac disease, who was getting, you know, sicker and sicker, who I was quite possibly contributing to his sickness. Also, the way that we understood the disease at the time had this kind of escalating sense of needing to contain his food so they would not make him sick. But no matter how we contain them, what I remember anyway was that it just nothing seemed to work. And so the question would then became, can we contain it further? Can we get things to be more pure, more healthy?
Yeah, it feels exhausting just to listen to it and to read about it.
Mm-hmm. Like, whoa, right? So then suddenly thinking, like realizing, or thinking about my own clouds of wheat flour and the, you know, historical clouds of wheat flour that set off this explosion at the Washburn A mill, I think it just provided me with an opportunity to start to understand how perhaps the ways that I was kind of knee-jerk nurturing were not helpful to myself or to my partner. And maybe there could be another way for me to take care of the people I love and take care of myself without this kind of like smothering nurturing that I was doing, whether he wanted it or not. Okay, now I've lost the question again. What's the question?
I think that's a good transition too, because again, what I really appreciate about this book is just how it explodes that elementary understanding of food as something that always nourishes, mm-hmm. or food that always brings people together. And certainly you have lots of chapters that talk about that or the opposite of that, but there are some like kiwi, yuzu, zucchini that do return to those heartwarming moments that we kind of expect. They are nice as a reader to come back to those moments where feeding and food really seem to be those metaphors for care and nurturing. And you still talk about those complications. They're not without complications. But maybe return to that question about, what is looking at the difficulty of food offer us as readers and listeners in relationship with that view of food as nourishing or caring or caregiving?
That's a great question. I mean, I think it offers a more authentic relationship with food, a more authentic relationship or more authentic story about how we actually eat and share and make food. You know, it's, I think the story that's often told us in cookbooks, perhaps because they have to, because their contract with the reader is a promise of pleasure, is that, you know, eating, cooking, and sharing food is going to be pleasurable. And it is that, but it's also so much more complicated than that. And I think I never want to rest merely on the positive and nurturing and sweet aspects of any kind of food. I know that any writing I read about that, any writing I do like that is a lie, to at least a certain extent, that there's, so engaging in difficulty, I mean, engaging in difficulty is also about like finding the conflict, and finding the conflict makes for good reading and good writing, right? We need that conflict, but being able to, yeah, to engage in thornier aspects of supposedly sweet subjects just, I think, allows the reader, allows the writer, allows the eater, allows the cook a closer and more authentic relationship with food.
Mm-hmm. Well, and now what the two cruel.
Did I say that?
That was
How many times did I say that?
Well, I think that, you know, the different ways of wording it always leads to slightly more, you know, information, right? More revelation. The cruelest questions of this podcast. One is, which are your favorite essays and recipes?
You know, I love my lump essay. That was about,
yes, and we didn't get to talk about it yet, but yeah, it's the one that's not really about fruit at all, right?
Well, it's most clearly about fruit as a metaphor. I'm thinking about this is a chapter where I'm talking about a breast cancer scare that I had, and the way that we describe possible, you know, tumors in terms of we describe the size of both. Jesus, sorry.
Tumors and fetuses.
In terms of, you know, how they compare to, you know, a certain size of fruit. And I loved it. Also describes a really important but thorny relationship that I had. And the kind of both guilt and freedom that I felt with ending that relationship. And I think I love that chapter because it really helped me come to terms with, I guess, the necessity of ending things sometimes, even if you feel like an asshole.
How about a favorite recipe?
Favorite recipe. I still come back to bandolin, which is a name for the gel that comes off of quince seeds. So if you take the seeds of a quince and immerse them in water and then just forget about them for an afternoon, come back, they'll be surrounded by this gel that they've exuded. And you can use that as a pomade for your hair. People used to use it in the 1800s for their hair. But you could also dissolve it in tea and it will soothe your sore throat.
Fascinating. I would not put any of my hair products in my throat. Second cruelest question. What other projects are you working on next? You've just finished this book. What's next?
I have to decide. There's two different ones that I'm thinking about, and I guess we'll just see kind of which one I figure my way into first. But one is called The Loudproof Room. It is based on an essay that I wrote about 7 years ago that was published in Best American Essays, also called The Loudproof Room. And it's about listening through hearing loss. So I'm trying to figure out, I guess, the ways my own disability the way that I can think about it as a sensibility. I don't know what that looks like in terms of what I would end up writing about, but I'm trying to figure that out right now. So that's an idea. The other idea is I really want to do a book with my cheese mentor, Laura Lee Misterly of Coolasaskett Farm. You know, one of the opportunities that I had through this apprenticeship program that we did with the Washington Center for Cultural Traditions was I just got to follow her around the kitchen. And I'm really, really interested in the ways that her cheese making practice is just encoded in her gestures, not just in her place, but in kind of what's available in her place, the equipment that she's jerry-rigged and bought over 40 years of making cheese, the, you know, ways that over time, as her life changes, as she gets older, her cheese changes just for all these tiny different reasons that you would never be able to encapsulate in a recipe. I think the way that she makes cheese feels like it is impossible to write down. So I am excited to try.
Those are both wonderful projects, and I will be looking for them both. Today, we've been talking to Kate Lebo about her newest book, The Book of Difficult Fruit, Arguments for the Tart, Tender, and Unruly with Recipes, published in 2021 by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Kate, thanks so much for being here. I feel like I've made a new friend today.
Me too. I can't wait for your book. It sounds fascinating.
Thank you. And thank you all for listening.